Flaming pine needles. I am literally a few yards from the door of the cement house when I pull up short. And that's not because of the smoke, or the prints, or the smell. That's because of the unmistakable click of a weapon behind me. Second nature. Instinct. I turn, drawing back the arrow, although I know already that the odds are not in my favor. I see the white peacekeeper uniform, the pointed chin, the light brown iris where my arrow will find a home. But the weapon is dropping to the ground, and the unarmed woman is holding something out to me in her gloved hand. Stop! She cries. I waver, unable to process this turn in events. Perhaps they have orders to bring me in alive, so they can torture me into incriminating every person I ever knew. Yeah, good luck with that, I think. My fingers have all but decided to release the arrow when I see the object in the glove. It's a small white circle of flat bread. More of a cracker, really, gray and soggy around the edges. But an image is clearly stamped in the center of it. It's my mockingjay. Part 2. The Quell. Chapter 10. It makes no sense. My bird baked into bread. Unlike the stylish renderings I saw in the Capitol, this is definitely not a fashion statement. What is it? What does that mean? I ask harshly, still prepared to kill. It means we're on your side, says a tremulous voice behind me. I didn't see her when I came up. She must have been in the house. I don't take my eyes off my current target. Probably the newcomer is armed, but I'm betting she won't risk letting me hear the click that would mean my death was imminent, knowing I would instantly kill her companion. Come around where I can see you, I order. She can't. She's... begins the woman with the cracker. Come around, I shout. There's a step and a dragging sound. I can hear the effort the movement requires. Another woman, or maybe I should call her a girl, since she looks about my age, limps into view. She's dressed in an ill-fitting peacekeeper's uniform, complete with the white fur cloak, but it's several sizes too large for her slight frame. She carries no visible weapon. Her hands are occupied with steadying a rough crutch made from a broken branch. The toe of her right boot can't clear the snow, hence the dragging. I examine the girl's face, which is bright red from the cold. Her teeth are crooked, and there's a strawberry birthmark over one of her chocolate brown eyes. This is no peacekeeper, no citizen of the capital either. Who are you? I ask warily, but less belligerently. My name's Twill, says the woman. She's older, maybe 35 or so. And this is Bonnie. We've run away from District 8. District 8? Then they must know about the uprising. Where'd you get the uniforms? I ask.
I stole them from the factory, says Bonnie. We make them there, only... I thought this one would be for someone else. That's why it fits so poorly.
The gun came from a dead peacekeeper, says Twill, following my eyes. That cracker in your hand, with the bird. What's that about? I ask.
Don't you know Katniss?
Bonnie appears genuinely surprised. They recognize me. Of course they recognize me. My face is uncovered, and I'm standing here outside of District 12 pointing an arrow at them. Who else would I be? I know it matches the pin I wore in the arena.
She doesn't know, says Bonnie softly. Maybe not about any of it.
Suddenly I feel the need to appear on top of things. I know you had an uprising in 8.
Yes, that's why we had to get out, says Twill.
Well, you're good and out now. What are you going to do? I ask.
We're headed for District 13, Twill replies. 13, I say. There's no 13. It got blown off the map. 75 years ago, says Twill.
Bonnie shifts on her crutch and winces.
What's wrong with your leg? I ask.
I twisted my ankle. My boots are too big, says Bonnie.
I bite my lip. My instinct tells me they're telling the truth, and behind that truth is a whole lot of information I'd like to get. I step forward and retrieve Twill's gun before lowering my bow, though. Then I hesitate a moment, thinking of another day in this woods when Gale and I watched a hovercraft appear out of thin air and capture two escapees from the capital. The boy was speared and killed. The red-headed girl, I found out when I went to the capital, was mutilated and turned into a mute servant called an Avox.
Anyone after you?
We don't think so. We think they believe we were killed in a factory explosion, says Twill.
Only a fluke that we weren't.
All right, let's go inside, I say, nodding at the cement house. I follow them in, carrying the gun.
Bonnie makes straight for the hearth and lowers herself onto a peacekeeper's cloak that has been spread before it. She holds her hands to the feeble flame that burns on one end of a charred log. Her skin is so pale as to be translucent, and I can see the fire glow through her flesh. Twill tries to arrange the cloak, which must have been her own, around the shivering girl. A 10-gallon can has been cut in half, the lip ragged and dangerous. It sits in the ashes, filled with a handful of pine needles steaming in water.
Making tea? I ask.
We're not sure, really. I remember seeing someone do this with pine needles on the Hunger Games a few years back. At least, I think it was pine needles, says Twill with a frown.
I remember District 8, an ugly urban place, stinking of industrial fumes, the people housed in run-down tenements, barely a blade of grass in sight, no opportunity ever to learn the ways of nature. It's a miracle these two have made it this far.
Out of food? I ask.
Bonnie nods.
We took what we could, but food's been so scarce. That's been gone for a while.
The quaver in her voice melts my remaining defenses. She is just a malnourished, injured girl fleeing the capital.
Well, then this is your lucky day, I say, dropping my game bag on the floor. People are starving all over the district, and we still have more than enough. So I've been spreading things around a little. I have my own priorities. Gale's family, Greasy Say, some of the other Hob traders who were shut down. My mother has other people, patients mostly, who she wants to help. This morning I purposely overstuffed my game bag with food, knowing my mother would see the depleted pantry and assume I was making my rounds to the hungry. I was actually buying time to go to the lake without her worrying. I intended to deliver the food this evening on my return, but now I can see that won't be happening. From the bag I pull two fresh buns with a layer of cheese baked into the top. We always seem to have a supply of these since Peter found out they were my favorite. I toss one to Twill, but cross over and place the other on Bonnie's lap, since her hand-eye coordination seems a little questionable at the moment, and I don't want the thing ending up in the fire.
Oh, says Bonnie. Oh, is this all for me?
Something inside me twists as I remember another voice. Rue. In the arena, when I gave her the leg of Grusling.
Oh, I've never had a whole leg to myself before.
The disbelief of the chronically hungry.
Yeah, eat up, I say. Bonnie holds the bun as if she can't quite believe it's real, and then sinks her teeth into it again and again, unable to stop.
It's better if you chew it.
She nods, trying to slow down, but I know how hard it is when you're that hollow.
I think your tea's done.
I scoot the tin can from the ashes.
Twill finds 2 tin cups in her pack, and I dip out the tea, setting it on the floor to cool. They huddle together, eating, blowing on their tea, and taking tiny, scalding sips as I build up the fire. I wait until they are sucking the grease from their fingers to ask, "So, what's your story?" And they tell me. Ever since the Hunger Games, the discontent in District 8 had been growing. It was always there, of course, to some degree, but what differed was that talk was no longer sufficient, and the idea of taking action went from a wish to a reality. The textile factories at Service Panem are loud with machinery, and the din also allowed word to pass safely. A pair of lips close to an ear, words unnoticed, unchecked. Twill taught at school. Bonnie was one of her pupils, and when the final bell had rung, both of them spent a 4-hour shift at the factory that specialized in the peacekeeper uniforms. It took months for Bonnie, who worked in the chilly inspection dock, to secure the 2 uniforms, a boot here, a pair of pants there. They were intended for Twill and her husband, because it was understood that once the uprising began, it would be crucial to get word of it out beyond District 8 if it were to spread and be successful. The day Peeta and I came through and made our victory tour appearance was actually a rehearsal of sorts. People in the crowd positioned themselves according to their teams, next to the buildings they would target when the rebellion broke out. That was the plan. To take over the centers of power in the city, like the Justice Building, the Peacekeepers' headquarters, and the communication center in the square. And at other locations in the district, the railroad, the granary, the power station, and the armory. The night of my engagement, the night Peeta fell to his knee and proclaimed his undying love for me in front of the cameras in the Capitol, was the night the uprising began. It was an ideal cover. Our victory tour interview with Caesar Flickerman was mandatory viewing. It gave the people of District 8 a reason to be out on the streets after dark, gathering either in the square or in various community centers around the city to watch. Ordinarily, such activities would have been too suspicious. Instead, everyone was in place by the appointed hour, 8 o'clock, when the masks went on and all hell broke loose. Taken by surprise and overwhelmed by sheer numbers, the peacekeepers were initially overcome by the crowds. The communication center, the granary, and the power station were all secured. As the peacekeepers fell, weapons were appropriated for the rebels. There was hope that this had not been an act of madness, that in some way, if they could get the word out to other districts, an actual overthrow of the government in the capital might be possible. But then the axe fell. Peacekeepers began to arrive by the thousands. Hovercraft bombed the rebel strongholds into ashes. In the utter chaos that followed, it was all people could do to make it back to their homes alive. It took less than 48 hours to subdue the city. Then, for a week, there was a lockdown. No food, no coal, everyone forbidden to leave their homes. The only time the television showed anything but static was when the suspected instigators were hanged in the square. Then one night, as the whole district was on the brink of starvation, came the order to return to business as usual. That meant school for Twill and Bonnie. A street made impassable by the bombs caused them to be late for their factory shift, so they were still 100 yards away when it exploded, killing everyone inside, including Twill's husband and Bonnie's entire family. Someone must have told the Capitol that the idea for the uprising had started there, Twill tells me faintly. The 2 fled back to Twill's, where the peacekeeper suits were still waiting. They scraped together what provisions they could, stealing freely from neighbors they now knew to be dead, and made it to the railroad station. In a warehouse near the tracks, they changed into the peacekeeper outfits, and disguised, were able to make it onto a boxcar full of fabric on a train headed to District 6.
They fled the train at a fuel stop along the way and traveled on foot. Concealed by woods, but using the tracks for guidance, they made it to the outskirts of District 12 2 days ago, where they were forced to stop when Bonnie twisted her ankle.
I understand why you're running, but what do you expect to find in District 13?
I ask. Bonnie and Twill exchange a nervous glance.
We're not exactly sure, Twill says. It's nothing but rubble, I say. We've all seen the footage.
That's just it. They've been using the same footage for as long as anyone in District 8 can remember, says Twill.
Really?
I try to think back, to call up the images of 13 I've seen on television.
You know how they always show the Justice Building?
Twill continues. I nod. I've seen it 1,000 times.
If you look very carefully, you'll see it. Up in the far right-hand corner.
See what? I ask. Twill holds out her cracker with the bird again.
A mockingjay. Just a glimpse of it as it flies by. The same one every time.
Back home, we think they keep reusing the old footage because the Capitol can't show what's really there now, says Bonnie.
I give a grunt of disbelief. You're going to District 13 based on that? A shot of a bird? You think you're going to find some new city with people strolling around in it, and that's just fine with the Capitol?
No, Twill says earnestly. We think the people moved underground when everything on the surface was destroyed. We think they've managed to survive, and we think the Capitol leaves them alone because, before the Dark Days, District 13's principal industry was nuclear development.
They were graphite miners, I say, but then I hesitate because that's information I got from the Capitol.
They had a few small mines, yes, but not enough to justify a population of that size. That, I guess, is the only thing we know for sure, says Twill.
My heart's beating too quickly. What if they're right? Could it be true? Could there be somewhere to run besides the wilderness? Somewhere safe? If a community exists in District 13, would it be better to go there, where I might be able to accomplish something, instead of waiting here for my death? But then, if there are people in District 13 with powerful weapons,
why haven't they helped us? I say angrily. If it's true, why do they leave us to live like this? With the hunger, and the killings, and the games.
And suddenly I hate this imaginary underground city of District 13, and those who sit by, watching us die. They're no better than the Capitol.
We don't know, Bonnie whispers. Right now, we're just holding on to the hope that they exist.
That snaps me to my senses. These are delusions. District 13 doesn't exist because the Capitol would never let it exist. They're probably mistaken about the footage. Mockingjays are about as rare as rocks, and about as tough. If they could survive the initial bombing of 13, they're probably doing better than ever now. Bonnie has no home. Her family is dead. Returning to District 8 or assimilating into another district would be impossible. Of course the idea of an independent, thriving District 13 draws her. I can't bring myself to tell her she's chasing a dream as insubstantial as a wisp of smoke. Perhaps she and Twill can carve out a life somehow in the woods. I doubt it, but they're so pitiful I have to try to help. First I give them all the food in my pack, grain and dried beans mostly, but there's enough to hold them for a while if they're careful. Then I take Twill out in the woods and try to explain the basics of hunting. She's got a weapon that, if necessary, can convert solar energy into deadly rays of power, so that could last indefinitely. When she manages to kill her first squirrel, the poor thing is mostly a charred mess because it took a direct hit to the body. But I show her how to skin and clean it. With some practice, she'll figure it out. I cut a new crutch for Bonnie. Back at the house, I peel off an extra layer of socks for the girl, telling her to stuff them into the toes of her boots to walk, then wear them on her feet at night. Finally, I teach them how to build a proper fire. They beg me for details of the situation in District 12, and I tell them about life under thread. I can see that they think this is important information that they'll be bringing to those who run District 13, and I play along so as not to destroy their hopes. But when the light signals late afternoon, I'm out of time to humor them. "I have to go now," I say. They pour out thanks and embrace me. Tears spill from Bonnie's eyes.
"I can't believe we actually got to meet you. You're practically all anyone's talked about since..."
"I know, I know. Since I pulled out those berries," I say, tiredly. I hardly notice the walk home, even though a wet snow begins to fall. My mind is spinning with new information about the uprising in District 8 and the unlikely but tantalizing possibility of District 13. Listening to Bonnie and Twill confirmed one thing. President Snow has been playing me for a fool. All the kisses and endearments in the world couldn't have derailed the momentum building up in District 8. Yes, my holding out the berries had been the spark, but I had no way to control the fire. He must have known that, so why visit my home? Why order me to persuade the crowd of my love for PETA? It was obviously a ploy to distract me and keep me from doing anything else inflammatory in the districts. And to entertain the people in the capital, of course. I suppose the wedding is just a necessary extension of that. I'm nearing the fence when a mockingjay lights on a branch and trills at me. At the sight of it, I realize I never got a full explanation of the bird on the cracker and what it signifies. "It means we're on your side." That's what Bonnie said. I have people on my side? What side? Am I unwittingly the face of the hoped-for rebellion? Has the mockingjay on my pin become a symbol of resistance? If so, my side's not doing too well. You only have to look at what happened in District 8 to know that. I stash my weapons in the hollow log nearest my old home in the seam and head for the fence. I'm crouched on one knee, preparing to enter the meadow, but I'm still so preoccupied with the day's events that it takes a sudden screech of an owl to bring me to my senses. In the fading light, the chain links look as innocuous as usual. But what makes me jerk back my hand is the sound, like the buzz of a tree full of tracker-jacker nests, indicating the fence is alive with electricity. Chapter 11. My feet back up automatically and I blend into the trees. I cover my mouth with my glove to disperse the white of my breath in the icy air. Adrenaline courses through me, wiping all the concerns of the day from my mind as I focus on the immediate threat before me. What is going on? Has Thread turned on the fence as an additional security precaution? Or does he somehow know I've escaped his net today? Is he determined to strand me outside District 12 until he can apprehend and arrest me? Drag me to the square to be locked in the stockade, or whipped, or hanged? Calm down, I order myself. It's not as if this is the first time I've been caught outside of the district by an electrified fence. It's happened a few times over the years, but Gale was always with me. The two of us would just pick a comfortable tree to hang out in until the power shut off, which it always did eventually. If I was running late, Prim even got in the habit of going to the meadow to check if the fence was charged to spare my mother worry. But today my family would never imagine I'd be in the woods. I've even taken steps to mislead them. So if I don't show up, worry they will. And there's a part of me that's worried too, because I'm not sure it's just a coincidence, the power coming on the very day I returned to the woods. I thought no one saw me sneak under the fence, but who knows? There are always eyes for hire. Someone reported Gale kissing me in that very spot. Still, that was in daylight,
and before I was more careful about my behavior. Could there be surveillance cameras? I've wondered about this before. Is this the way President Snow knows about the kiss? It was dark when I went under, and my face was bundled in a scarf, but the list of suspects likely to be trespassing into the woods is probably very short. My eyes peer through the trees, past the fence, into the meadow. All I can see is the wet snow illuminated here and there by the light from the windows on the edge of the seam. No peacekeepers in sight, no signs I am being hunted. Whether Thread knows I left the district today or not, I realize my course of action must be the same, to get back inside the fence unseen and pretend I never left. Any contact with the chain link or the coils of barbed wire that guard the top would mean instant electrocution. I don't think I can burrow under the fence without risking detection, and the ground's frozen hard anyway. That leaves only one choice. Somehow, I'm going to have to go over it. I begin to skirt along the tree line, searching for a tree with a branch high and long enough to fit my needs. After about a mile, I come upon an old maple that might do. The trunk is too wide and icy to shimmy up, though, and there are no low branches. I climb a neighboring tree and leap precariously into the maple, almost losing my hold on the slick bark. But I manage to get a grip and slowly inch my way out on a limb that hangs above the barbed wire. As I look down, I remember why Gale and I always waited in the woods rather than try to tackle the fence. Being high enough to avoid getting fried means you've got to be at least 20 feet in the air. I guess my branch must be 25. That's a dangerously long drop, even for someone who's had years of practice in trees. But what choice do I have? I could look for another branch, but it's almost dark now. The falling snow will obscure any moonlight. Here, at least, I can see I've got a snowbank to cushion my landing. Even if I could find another, which is doubtful, who knows what I'd be jumping into? I throw my empty game bag around my neck and slowly lower myself until I'm hanging by my hands. For a moment, I gather my courage. Then I release my fingers. There's the sensation of falling. Then I hit the ground with a jolt that goes right up my spine. A second later, my rear end slams the ground. I lie in the snow trying to assess the damage. Without standing, I can tell by the pain in my left heel and my tailbone that I'm injured. The only question is, how badly? I'm hoping for bruises, but when I force myself onto my feet, I suspect I've broken something as well. I can walk, though, so I get moving, trying to hide my limp as best I can. My mother and Prim can't know I was in the woods. I need to work up some sort of alibi, no matter how thin. Some of the shops in the square are still open, so I go in one and purchase white cloth for bandages. We're running low anyway. In another, I buy a bag of sweets for Prim. I stick one of the candies in my mouth, feeling the peppermint melt on my tongue, and realize it's the first thing I've eaten all day. I meant to make a meal at the lake, but once I saw Twill and Bonnie's condition, it seemed wrong to take a single mouthful from them. By the time I reach my house, my left heel will bear no weight at all. I decide to tell my mother I was trying to mend a leak in the roof of our old house and slid off. As for the missing food, I'll just be vague about who I handed it out to. I drag myself in the door, all ready to collapse in front of the fire, but instead, I get another shock. Two peacekeepers, a man and a woman, are standing in the doorway to our kitchen. The woman remains impassive, but I catch the flicker of surprise on the man's face. I am unanticipated. They know I was in the woods and should be trapped there now. "Hello," I say in a neutral voice. My mother appears behind them, but keeps her distance. "Here she is, just in time for dinner," she says a little too brightly.
I'm very late for dinner. I consider removing my boots as I normally would, but doubt I can manage it without revealing my injuries. Instead, I just pull off my wet hood and shake the snow from my hair. "Can I help you with something?" I ask the peacekeepers. "Head Peacekeeper Thread sent us with a message for you," says the woman. "They've been waiting for hours," my mother adds. "They've been waiting for me to fail to return, to confirm I got electrocuted by the fence or trapped in the woods so they could take my family in for questioning."
"Must be an important message," I say.
"May we ask where you've been, Miss Everdeen?" the woman asks. "Easier to ask where I haven't been," I say with a sound of exasperation. I cross into the kitchen, forcing myself to use my foot normally, even though every step is excruciating. I pass between the peacekeepers and make it to the table all right. I fling my bag down and turn to Prim, who's standing stiffly by the hearth. Haymitch and Peeta are there as well, sitting in a pair of matching rockers, playing a game of chess. Were they here by chance, or invited by the peacekeepers? Either way, I'm glad to see them.
"So where haven't you been?" says Haymitch in a bored voice.
"Well, I haven't been talking to the goat man about getting Prim's goat pregnant because someone gave me completely inaccurate information as to where he lives," I say to Prim emphatically.
"No, I didn't," says Prim. "I told you exactly."
"You said he lives beside the west entrance to the mine," I say.
"The east entrance,"
Prim corrects me. "You distinctly said the west, because then I said, next to the slag heap, and you said, yeah," I say.
"The slag heap next to the east entrance," says Prim patiently.
"No, when did you say that?" I demand.
"Last night," Haymitch chimes in.
"It was definitely the east," adds Peeta. He looks at Haymitch and they laugh. I glare at Peeta, and he tries to look contrite.
"I'm sorry, but it's what I've been saying. You don't listen when people talk to you."
"Bet people told you he didn't live there today, and you didn't listen again," says Haymitch.
"Shut up, Haymitch," I say, clearly indicating he's right.
Haymitch and Peeta crack up, and Prim allows herself a smile. "Fine. Somebody else can arrange to get the stupid goat knocked up," I say, which makes them laugh more. And I think, this is why they've made it this far, Haymitch and Peeta. Nothing throws them. I look at the peacekeepers. The man's smiling, but the woman is unconvinced.
"What's in the bag?" she asks sharply. I know she's hoping for game or wild plants. Something that clearly condemns me. I dump the contents on the table.
"See for yourself."
"Oh, good," says my mother, examining the cloth. "We're running low on bandages."
Peeta comes to the table and opens the candy bag.
"Ooh, peppermints," he says, popping one in his mouth.
"They're mine." I take a swipe for the bag. He tosses it to Haymitch, who stuffs a fistful of sweets in his mouth before passing the bag to a giggling Prim.
"None of you deserves candy," I say.
"What, because we're right?"
Peeta wraps his arms around me. I give a small yelp of pain as my tailbone objects. I try to turn it into a sound of indignation, but I can see in his eyes that he knows I'm hurt.
"Okay, Prim said west. I distinctly heard west. And we're all idiots. How's that?"
"Better," I say, and accept his kiss. Then I look at the peacekeepers as if suddenly remembering they're there.
"You have a message for me?"
"From the head peacekeeper Thread," says the woman. "He wanted you to know that the fence surrounding District 12 will now have electricity 24 hours a day."
"Didn't it already?"
I ask, a little too innocently.
"He thought you might be interested in passing this information on to your cousin."
says the woman.
Thank you, I'll tell him.
I'm sure we'll all sleep a little more soundly now that security has addressed that lapse. I'm pushing things, I know it, but the comment gives me a sense of satisfaction. The woman's jaw tightens. None of this has gone as planned, but she has no further orders. She gives me a curt nod and leaves, the man trailing in her wake. When my mother has locked the door behind them, I slump against the table. "What is it?" says Peter, holding me steadily.
"Oh, I banged up my left foot, the heel, and my tailbone's had a bad day, too." He helps me over to one of the rockers, and I lower myself onto the padded cushion. My mother eases off my boots.
"What happened?"
"I slipped and fell," I say.
Four pairs of eyes look at me with disbelief.
"On some ice?"
But we all know the house must be bugged, and it's not safe to talk openly. Not here, not now. Having stripped off my sock, my mother's fingers probe the bones in my left heel, and I wince.
"There might be a break," she says. She checks the other foot. "This one seems all right."
She judges my tailbone to be badly bruised. Prim's dispatched to get my pajamas and robe. When I'm changed, my mother makes a snowpack for my left heel and props it up on a hassock. I eat three bowls of stew and half a loaf of bread while the others dine at the table. I stare at the fire, thinking of Bonnie and Twill, hoping that the heavy, wet snow has erased my tracks. Prim comes and sits on the floor next to me, leaning her head against my knee. We suck on peppermints as I brush her soft, blonde hair back behind her ear.
"How was school?" I ask.
"All right. We learned about coal byproducts," she says. We stare at the fire for a while. "Are you going to try on your wedding dresses?"
"Not tonight. Tomorrow, probably," I say.
"Wait until I get home, okay?" she says.
"Sure,
if they don't arrest me first." My mother gives me a cup of chamomile tea with a dose of sleep syrup, and my eyelids begin to droop immediately. She wraps my bad foot, and Peter volunteers to get me to bed. I start out by leaning on his shoulder, but I'm so wobbly he just scoops me up and carries me upstairs. He tucks me in and says good night, but I catch his hand and hold him there. A side effect of the sleep syrup is that it makes people less inhibited, like white liquor, and I know I have to control my tongue. But I don't want him to go. In fact, I want him to climb in with me, to be there when the nightmares hit tonight. For some reason that I can't quite form, I know I'm not allowed to ask that.
"Don't go yet, not until I fall asleep," I say.
Peter sits on the side of the bed, warming my hand in both of his.
"Almost thought you'd changed your mind today, when you were late for dinner."
I'm foggy, but I can guess what he means. With the fence going on and me showing up late and the peacekeepers waiting, he thought I'd made a run for it, maybe with Gale.
"No, I'd have told you," I say.
I pull his hand up and lean my cheek against the back of it, taking in the faint scent of cinnamon and dill from the breads he must have baked today. I want to tell him about Twill and Bonnie and the uprising and the fantasy of District 13, but it's not safe to, and I can feel myself slipping away, so I just get out one more sentence.
"Stay with me."
As the tendrils of sleep syrup pull me down, I hear him whisper a word back, but I don't quite catch it. My mother lets me sleep until noon, then rouses me to examine my heel. I'm ordered to a week of bed rest, and I don't object because I feel so lousy. Not just my heel and my tailbone, my whole body aches with exhaustion. So I let my mother doctor me and feed me breakfast in bed and tuck another quilt around me. Then I just lie there, staring out my window at the winter sky, pondering how on earth this will all turn out. I think a lot about Bonnie and Twill and the pile of white wedding dresses downstairs, and if Thread will figure out how I got back in and arrest me. It's funny, because he could just arrest me anyway based on past crimes. But maybe he has to have something really irrefutable to do it now that I'm a victor. And I wonder if President Snow's in contact with Thread. I think it's unlikely he ever acknowledged that old Cray existed, but now that I'm such a nationwide problem, is he carefully instructing Thread what to do, or is Thread acting on his own? At any rate, I'm sure they'd both agree on keeping me locked up here inside the district with that fence. Even if I could figure out some way to escape, maybe get a rope up to that maple tree branch and climb out, there'd be no escaping with my family and friends now. I told Gale I would stay and fight anyway. For the next few days, I jump every time there's a knock on the door. No peacekeepers show up to arrest me, though, so eventually I begin to relax. I'm further reassured when Peeta casually tells me the power is off in sections of the fence because crews are out securing the base of the chain link to the ground. Thread must believe I somehow got under the thing, even with that deadly current running through it. It's a break for the district, having the peacekeepers busy doing something besides abusing people. Peeta comes by every day to bring me cheese buns and begins to help me work on the family book. It's an old thing, made of parchment and leather. Some herbalist on my mother's side of the family started it ages ago. The book's composed of page after page of ink drawings of plants with descriptions of their medical uses. My father added a section on edible plants that was my guidebook to keeping us alive after his death. For a long time, I've wanted to record my own knowledge in it. Things I learned from experience or from Gale, and then the information I picked up when I was training for the games. I didn't because I'm no artist, and it's so crucial that the pictures are drawn in exact detail. That's where Peeta comes in. Some of the plants he knows already, others we have dried samples of, and others I have to describe. He makes sketches on scrap paper until I'm satisfied they're right, then I let him draw them in the book. After that, I carefully print all I know about the plant. It's quiet, absorbing work that helps take my mind off my troubles. I like to watch his hands as he works, making a blank page bloom with strokes of ink, adding touches of color to our previously black and yellowish book. His face takes on a special look when he concentrates. His usual easy expression is replaced by something more intense and removed that suggests an entire world locked away inside him. I've seen flashes of this before, in the arena, or when he speaks to a crowd, or that time he shoved the peacekeeper's guns away from me in District 11. I don't know quite what to make of it. I also become a little fixated on his eyelashes, which ordinarily you don't notice much because they're so blonde. But up close, in the sunlight slanting in from the window, they're a light golden color and so long, I don't see how they keep from getting all tangled up when he blinks. One afternoon, Peeta stops shading a blossom and looks up so suddenly that I start, as though I were caught spying on him, which in a strange way, maybe I was. But he only says, "You know, I think this is the first time we've ever done anything normal together." "Yeah," I agree. Our whole relationship has been tainted by the games. Normal was never a part of it. Nice for a change. Each afternoon he carries me downstairs for a change of scenery, and I unnerve everyone by turning on the television. Usually we only watch when it's mandatory, because the mixture of propaganda and displays of the capital's power, including clips from the 74 years of Hunger Games, is so odious. But now I'm looking for something special, the mockingjay that Bonnie and Twill are basing all their hopes on.
I know it's probably foolishness, but if it is, I want to rule it out. And erase the idea of a thriving District 13 from my mind for good. My first sighting is in a news story referencing the dark days. I see the smoldering remains of the Justice Building in District 13 and just catch the black and white underside of a mockingjay's wing as it flies across the upper right-hand corner. That doesn't prove anything, really. It's just an old shot that goes with an old tale. However, several days later, something else grabs my attention. The main newscaster is reading a piece about a shortage of graphite affecting the manufacturing of items in District 3. They cut to what is supposed to be live footage of a female reporter encased in a protective suit standing in front of the ruins of the Justice Building in 13. Through her mask, she reports that unfortunately a study has just today determined that the mines of District 13 are still too toxic to approach. End of story. But just before they cut back to the main newscaster, I see the unmistakable flash of that same Mockingjay's wing. The reporter has simply been incorporated into the old footage. She's not in District 13 at all, which begs the question, what is? Chapter 12. Staying quietly in bed is harder after that. I want to be doing something, finding out more about District 13, or helping in the cause to bring down the Capitol. Instead, I sit around stuffing myself with cheese buns and watching Peeta sketch. Haymitch stops by occasionally to bring me news from town, which is always bad. More people being punished or dropping from starvation. Winter has begun to withdraw by the time my foot is deemed usable. My mother gives me exercises to do and lets me walk on my own a bit. I go to sleep one night, determined to go into town the next morning, but I wake to find Venia, Octavia, and Flavius grinning down at me.
"Surprise!" they squeal. "We're here early!"
After I took that lash in the face, Haymitch got their visit pushed back several months so I could heal up. I wasn't expecting them for another 3 weeks, but I try to act delighted that my bridal photo shoot is here at last. My mother hung up all the dresses, so they're ready to go, but to be honest, I haven't even tried one on. After the usual histrionics about the deteriorated state of my beauty, they get right down to business. Their biggest concern is my face, although I think my mother did a pretty remarkable job healing it. There's just a pale pink strip across my cheekbone. The whipping's not common knowledge, so I tell them I slipped on the ice and cut it, and then I realize that's my same excuse for hurting my foot, which is going to make walking in high heels a problem. But Flavius, Octavia, and Venia aren't the suspicious types, so I'm safe there. Since I only have to look hairless for a few hours instead of several weeks, I get to be shaved instead of waxed. I still have to soak in a tub of something, but it isn't vile, and we're on to my hair and makeup before I know it. The team, as usual, is full of news, which I usually do my best to tune out. But then Octavia makes a comment that catches my attention. It's a passing remark, really, about how she couldn't get shrimp for a party, but it tugs at me. "Why couldn't you get shrimp? Is it out of season?" I ask.
"Oh, Katniss, we haven't been able to get any seafood for weeks," says Octavia. "You know, because the weather's been so bad in District 4.
My mind starts buzzing. No seafood for weeks from District 4. The barely concealed rage in the crowd during the victory tour. And suddenly I am absolutely sure that District 4 has revolted. I begin to question them casually about what other hardships this winter has brought them. They are not used to want, so any little disruption in supply makes an impact on them. By the time I'm ready to be dressed, their complaints about the difficulty of getting different products, from crab meat to music chips to ribbons, has given me a sense of which districts might actually be rebelling. Seafood from District 4, electronic gadgets from District 3, and of course, fabrics from District 8. The thought of such widespread rebellion has me quivering with fear and excitement. I want to ask them more, but Cinna appears to give me a hug and check my makeup. His attention goes right to the scar on my cheek. Somehow I don't think he believes the slipping on the ice story, but he doesn't question it. He simply adjusts the powder on my face, and what little you can see of the lash mark vanishes. Downstairs, the living room has been cleared and lit for the photo shoot. Effie's having a fine time ordering everybody around, keeping us all on schedule. It's probably a good thing, because there are 6 gowns, and each one requires its own headpiece, shoes, jewelry, hair, makeup, setting, and lighting. Creamy lace and pink roses and ringlets. Ivory satin and gold tattoos and greenery. A sheath of diamonds and jeweled veil and moonlight. Heavy white silk and sleeves that fall from my wrist to the floor and pearls. The moment one shot has been approved, we move right into preparing for the next. I feel like dough being kneaded and reshaped again and again. My mother manages to feed me bits of food and sips of tea while they work on me. But by the time the shoot is over, I'm starving and exhausted. I'm hoping to spend some time with Cinna now, but Effie whisks everybody out the door, and I have to make do with the promise of a phone call. Evening has fallen, and my foot hurts from all the crazy shoes, so I abandon any thoughts of going into town. Instead, I go upstairs and wash away the layers of makeup and conditioners and dyes, and then go down to dry my hair by the fire. Prim, who came home from school in time to see the last 2 dresses, chatters on about them with my mother. They both seem overly happy about the photo shoot. When I fall into bed, I realize it's because they think it means I'm safe, that the Capitol has overlooked my interference with the whipping, since no one is going to go to such trouble and expense for someone they plan on killing anyway, right? In my nightmare, I'm dressed in the silk bridal gown, but it's torn and muddy. The long sleeves keep getting caught on thorns and branches as I run through the woods. The pack of Mutation tributes draws closer and closer until it overcomes me with hot breath and dripping fangs, and I scream myself awake. It's too close to dawn to bother trying to get back to sleep. Besides, today I really have to get out and talk to someone. Gale will be unreachable in the mines, but I need Haymitch or Peeta or somebody to share the burden of all that has happened to me since I went to the lake. Fleeing outlaws, electrified fences, an independent District 13, shortages in the Capitol, everything. I eat breakfast with my mother and Prim and head out in search of a confidant. The air's warm, with hopeful hints of spring in it. Spring would be a good time for an uprising, I think. Everyone feels less vulnerable once winter passes. Peeta's not home. I guess he's already gone into town. I'm surprised to see Haymitch moving around his kitchen so early, though. I walk into his house without knocking. I can hear Hazel upstairs, sweeping the floors of the now spotless house. Haymitch isn't flat-out drunk, but he doesn't look too steady either. I guess the rumors about Ripper being back in business are true. I'm thinking maybe I better let him just go to bed when he suggests a walk to town. Haymitch and I can speak in a kind of shorthand now. In a few minutes, I've updated him, and he's told me about the rumors of uprisings in District 7 and 11 as well. If my hunches are right, this would mean almost half the districts have at least attempted to rebel. "Do you still think it won't work here?" I ask.
"Not yet. Those other districts..."
They're much larger. Even if half the people cower in their homes, the rebels stand a chance. Here in 12, it's got to be all of us or nothing, he says.
I hadn't thought of that, how we lack strength of numbers. But maybe at some point, I insist.
Maybe. But we're small, we're weak, and we don't develop nuclear weapons, says Haymitch with a touch of sarcasm.
He didn't get too excited over my District 13 story. What do you think they'll do, Haymitch, to the districts that are rebelling? I ask.
Well, you've heard what they did in 8. You've seen what they did here, and that was without provocation, says Haymitch. If things really do get out of hand, I think they'll have no problem killing off another district, same as they did 13. Make an example of it, you know?
So you think 13 is really destroyed? I mean, Bonnie and Twill were right about the footage of the Mockingjay, I say.
Okay, but what does that prove?
Nothing, really. There are plenty of reasons they could be using old footage.
Probably it looks more impressive, and it's a lot simpler, isn't it, to just press a few buttons in the editing room than to fly all the way out there and film it, he says. The idea that 13 has somehow rebounded and the Capitol is ignoring it? That sounds like the kind of rumor desperate people cling to.
I know. I was just hoping, I say.
Exactly, because you're desperate, says Haymitch.
I don't argue because, of course, he's right. Prim comes home from school, bubbling over with excitement. The teachers announced there was mandatory programming tonight.
I think it's going to be your photo shoot.
It can't be, Prim. They only did the pictures yesterday, I tell her.
Well, that's what somebody heard, she says.
I'm hoping she's wrong. I haven't had time to prepare Gale for any of this. Since the whipping, I only see him when he comes to the house for my mother to check how he's healing. He's often scheduled 7 days a week in the mine. In the few minutes of privacy we've had, with me walking him back to town, I gather that the rumblings of an uprising in 12 have been subdued by Thread's crackdown. He knows I'm not going to run. But he must also know that if we don't revolt in 12, I'm destined to be Peter's bride. Seeing me lounging around in gorgeous gowns on his television, what can he do with that? When we gather around the television at 7:30, I discover that Prim is right. Sure enough, there's Caesar Flickerman, speaking before a standing-room-only crowd in front of the training center, talking to an appreciative crowd about my upcoming nuptials. He introduces Cinna, who became an overnight star with his costumes for me in the games, and after a minute of good-natured chit-chat, we are directed to turn our attention to a giant screen. I see now how they could photograph me yesterday and present the special tonight. Initially, Cinna designed 24 wedding gowns. Since then, there's been the process of narrowing down the designs, creating the dresses, and choosing the accessories. Apparently, in the Capitol, there were opportunities to vote for your favorite at each stage. This is all culminating with shots of me in the final 6 dresses, which I'm sure took no time at all to insert in the show. Each shot is met with a huge reaction from the crowd. People screaming and cheering for their favorites, booing the ones they don't like. Having voted and probably bet on the winner, people are very invested in my wedding gown. It's bizarre to watch when I think how I never even bothered to try one on before the cameras arrived. Caesar announces that interested parties must cast their final vote by noon on the following day.
"Let's get Katniss Everdeen to her wedding in style," he hollers to the crowd.
I'm about to shut off the television, but then Caesar is telling us to stay tuned for the other big event of the evening.
That's right. This year will be the 75th anniversary of the Hunger Games, and that means it's time for our third quarter quell.
What will they do? asks Prim. It isn't for months yet. We turn to our mother, whose expression is solemn and distant, as if she's remembering something. Must be the reading of the card. The anthem plays, and my throat tightens with revulsion as President Snow takes the stage. He's followed by a young boy dressed in a white suit, holding a simple wooden box. The anthem ends, and President Snow begins to speak to remind us all of the dark days from which the Hunger Games were born. When the laws of the games were laid out, they dictated that every 25 years the anniversary would be marked by a quarter quell. It would call for a glorified version of the games to make fresh the memory of those killed by the district's rebellion. These words could not be more pointed, since I suspect several districts are rebelling right now. President Snow goes on to tell us what happened in the previous quarter quells.
On the 25th anniversary, as a reminder to the rebels that their children were dying because of their choice to initiate violence, every district was made to hold an election and vote on the tributes who would represent it.
I wonder how that would have felt, picking the kids who had to go. It is worse, I think, to be turned over by your own neighbors than to have your name drawn from the reaping ball.
On the 50th anniversary, the president continues, as a reminder that two rebels died for each capital citizen, every district was required to send twice as many tributes.
I imagine facing a field of 47 instead of 23. Worse odds, less hope, and ultimately, more dead kids. That was the year Haymitch won.
I had a friend who went that year, says my mother quietly. Maisalie Donner. Her parents owned the sweet shop. They gave me her songbird after, a canary.
Prim and I exchange a look. It's the first time we've ever heard of Maisalie Donner. Maybe because my mother knew we would want to know how she died.
And now we honor our third quarter quell, says the president.
The little boy in white steps forward, holding out the box as he opens the lid. We can see the tidy, upright rows of yellowed envelopes.
Whoever devised the quarter quell system had prepared for centuries of Hunger Games.
The president removes an envelope, clearly marked with a 75. He runs his finger under the flap and pulls out a small square of paper. Without hesitation, he reads,
On the 75th anniversary, as a reminder to the rebels that even the strongest among them cannot overcome the power of the capital, the male and female tributes will be reaped from their existing pool of victors.
My mother gives a faint shriek, and Prim buries her face in her hands. But I feel more like the people I see in the crowd on television, slightly baffled. What does it mean? Existing pool of victors? Then I get it, what it means, at least for me. District 12 only has 3 existing victors to choose from. 2 male, 1 female. I am going back into the arena.
Chapter 13.
My body reacts before my mind does, and I'm running out the door, across the lawns of the victor's village, into the dark beyond. Moisture from the sodden ground soaks my socks, and I'm aware of the sharp bite of the wind, but I don't stop. Where to go? The woods, of course. I'm at the fence before the hum makes me remember how very trapped I am. I back away, panting, turn on my heel, and take off again. The next thing I know, I'm on my hands and knees in the cellar of one of the empty houses in the victor's village. Faint shafts of moonlight come in through the window wells above my head. I'm cold and wet and winded, but my escape attempt has done nothing to subdue the hysteria rising up inside me.
It will drown me unless it's released. I ball up the front of my shirt, stuff it into my mouth, and begin to scream. How long this continues, I don't know, but when I stop, my voice is almost gone. I curl up on my side and stare at the patches of moonlight on the cement floor. Back in the arena. Back in the place of nightmares. That's where I'm going. I have to admit, I didn't see it coming. I saw a multitude of other things being publicly humiliated, tortured, and executed, fleeing through the wilderness, pursued by peacekeepers and hovercraft. Marriage to Peeta, with our children forced into the arena. But never that I myself would have to be a player in the games again. Why? Because there's no precedent for it. Victors are out of the reaping for life. That's the deal if you win. Until now. There's some kind of sheeting, the kind they put down when they paint. I pull it over me like a blanket. In the distance, someone is calling my name. But at the moment, I excuse myself from thinking about even those I love most. I think only of me and what lies ahead. The sheeting's stiff but holds warmth. My muscles relax. My heart rate slows. I see the wooden box in the little boy's hands, President Snow drawing out the yellowed envelope. Is it possible that this was really the quarter quell written down 75 years ago? It seems unlikely. It's just too perfect an answer for the troubles that face the capital today. Getting rid of me and subduing the districts all in one neat little package. I hear President Snow's voice in my head. On the 75th anniversary, as a reminder to the rebels that even the strongest among them cannot overcome the power of the capital, the male and female tributes will be reaped from their existing pool of victors. Yes, victors are our strongest. They're the ones who survived the arena and slipped the noose of poverty that strangles the rest of us. They, or should I say we, are the very embodiment of hope where there is no hope. And now, 23 of us will be killed to show how even that hope was an illusion. I'm glad I won only last year. Otherwise, I'd know all the other victors, not just because I see them on television, but because they're guests at every games. Even if they're not mentoring like Haymitch always has to, most return to the capital each year for the event. I think a lot of them are friends, whereas the only friend I'll have to worry about killing will be either Peeta or Haymitch. Peeta or Haymitch! I sit straight up, throwing off the sheeting. What just went through my mind? There's no situation in which I would ever kill Peeta or Haymitch. But one of them will be in the arena with me, and that's a fact. They may have even decided between them who it will be. Whoever is picked first, the other will have the option of volunteering to take his place. I already know what will happen. Peeta will ask Haymitch to let him go into the arena with me no matter what, for my sake, to protect me. I stumble around the cellar looking for an exit. How did I even get into this place? I feel my way up the steps to the kitchen and see the glass window in the door has been shattered. Must be why my hand seems to be bleeding. I hurry back into the night and head straight to Haymitch's house. He's sitting alone at the kitchen table, a half-emptied bottle of white liquor in one fist, his knife in the other. Drunk as a skunk.
Ah, there she is, all tuckered out. Finally did the math, did you, sweetheart? Worked out you won't be going in alone. And now you're here to ask me what? He says.
I don't answer. The window's wide open and the wind cuts through me just as if I were outside.
I'll admit, it was easier for the boy. He was here before I could snap the seal on a bottle, begging me for another chance to go in. But
What can you say?
He mimics my voice.
Take his place, hey, Mitch? Because all things being equal, I'd rather Peter had a crack at the rest of his life than you.
I bit my lip, because once he said it, I'm afraid that's what I do want. For Peter to live, even if it means Haymitch's death. No, I don't. He's dreadful, of course, but Haymitch is my family now. What did I come for, I think? What could I possibly want here?
I came for a drink, I say. Haymitch bursts out laughing and slams the bottle on the table before me. I run my sleeve across the top and take a couple gulps before I come up choking. It takes a few minutes to compose myself, and even then my eyes and nose are still streaming. But inside me, the liquor feels like fire, and I like it.
Maybe it should be you, I say matter-of-factly as I pull up a chair. You hate life anyway.
Very true, says Haymitch. And since last time I tried to keep you alive, seems like I'm obligated to save the boy this time.
That's another good point, I say, wiping my nose and tipping up the bottle again.
Peter's argument is that since I chose you, I now owe him anything he wants, and what he wants is the chance to go in again to protect you, says Haymitch.
I knew it. In this way, Peter's not hard to predict. While I was wallowing around on the floor of that cellar, thinking only of myself, he was here, thinking only of me. Shame isn't a strong enough word for what I feel.
You could live 100 lifetimes and not deserve him, you know, Haymitch says.
Yeah, yeah, I say brusquely. No question, he's the superior one of this trio. So what are you going to do?
I don't know, Haymitch sighs. Go back in with you, maybe, if I can. If my name's drawn at the reaping, it won't matter. He'll just volunteer to take my place.
We sit for a while in silence. It'd be bad for you in the arena, wouldn't it, knowing all of the others? I ask.
Oh, I think we can count on it being unbearable wherever I am.
He nods at the bottle.
Can I have that back now?
No, I say, wrapping my arms around it. Haymitch pulls another bottle out from under the table and gives the top a twist. But I realize I am not just here for a drink. There's something else I want from Haymitch. Okay, I figured out what I'm asking, I say. If it is Peter and me in the games, this time we try to keep him alive. Something flickers across his bloodshot eyes. Pain.
Like you said, it's going to be bad no matter how you slice it. And whatever Peter wants, it's his turn to be saved. We both owe him that.
My voice takes on a pleading tone.
Besides, the capital hates me so much I'm as good as dead now. He still might have a chance. Please, Haymitch, say you'll help me.
He frowns at his bottle, weighing my words.
All right, he says finally.
Thanks, I say. I should go see Peter now, but I don't want to. My head's spinning from the drink, and I'm so wiped out, who knows what he could get me to agree to. No. Now I have to go home to face my mother and Prim. As I stagger up the steps to my house, the front door opens and Gale pulls me into his arms.
I was wrong. We should have gone when you said, he whispers.
No, I say. I'm having trouble focusing, and liquor keeps sloshing out of my bottle and down the back of Gale's jacket, but he doesn't seem to care.
It's not too late, he says.
Over his shoulder, I see my mother and Prim clutching each other in the doorway. We run, they die. And now I've got Peter to protect. End of discussion.
Yeah, it is.
My knees give way, and he's holding me up. As the alcohol overcomes my mind, I hear the glass bottle shatter on the floor. This seems appropriate, since I have obviously lost my grip on everything. When I wake up, I barely get to the toilet before the white liquor makes its reappearance. It burns just as much coming up as it did going down, and tastes twice as bad. I'm trembling and sweaty when I finish vomiting, but at least most of the stuff is out of my system. Enough made it into my bloodstream, though, to result in a pounding headache, parched mouth, and boiling stomach. I turn on the shower and stand under the warm rain for a minute before I realize I'm still in my underclothes. My mother must have stripped off my filthy outer ones and tucked me in bed. I throw the wet undergarments into the sink and pour shampoo on my head. My hands sting, and that's when I notice the stitches, small and even, across one palm and up the side of the other hand. Vaguely, I remember breaking that glass window last night. I scrub myself from head to toe, only stopping to throw up again right in the shower. It's mostly just bile and goes down the drain with the sweet-smelling bubbles. Finally clean, I pull on my robe and head back to bed, ignoring my dripping hair. I climb under the blankets, sure this is what it must feel like to be poisoned. The footsteps on the stairs renew my panic from last night. I'm not ready to see my mother and Prim. I have to pull myself together to be calm and reassuring, the way I was when we said our goodbyes the day of the last reaping. I have to be strong. I struggle into an upright position, push my wet hair off my throbbing temples, and brace myself for this meeting. They appear in the doorway, holding tea and toast, their faces filled with concern. I open my mouth, planning to start off with some kind of joke, and burst into tears. So much for being strong. My mother sits on the side of the bed, and Prim crawls right up next to me, and they hold me, making quiet, soothing sounds, until I am mostly cried out. Then Prim gets a towel and dries my hair, combing out the knots, while my mother coaxes tea and toast into me. They dress me in warm pajamas and layer more blankets on me, and I drift off again. I can tell by the light it's late afternoon when I come round again. There's a glass of water on my bedside table, and I gulp it down, thirstily. My stomach and head still feel rocky, but much better than they did earlier. I rise, dress, and braid back my hair. Before I go down, I pause at the top of the stairs, feeling slightly embarrassed about the way I've handled the news of the Quarter Quell. My erratic flight, drinking with Haymitch, weeping. Given the circumstances, I guess I deserve one day of indulgence. I'm glad the cameras weren't here for it, though. Downstairs, my mother and Prim embrace me again, but they're not overly emotional. I know they're holding things in to make it easier on me. Looking at Prim's face, it's hard to imagine she's the same frail little girl I left behind on reaping day 9 months ago. The combination of that ordeal and all that has followed, the cruelty in the district, the parade of sick and wounded that she often treats by herself now if my mother's hands are too full, these things have aged her years. She's grown quite a bit, too. We're practically the same height now, but that isn't what makes her seem so much older. My mother ladles out a mug of broth for me, and I ask for a second mug to take to Haymitch. Then I walk across the lawn to his house. He's only just waking up and accepts the mug without comment. We sit there, almost peacefully, sipping our broth and watching the sun set through his living room window. I hear someone walking around upstairs, and I assume it's Hazel. But a few minutes later, Peter comes down and tosses a cardboard box of empty liquor bottles on the table with finality. "There, it's done," he says. It's taking all of Haymitch's resources to focus his eyes on the bottles, so I speak up. What's done?
I've poured all the liquor down the drain, says Peeta. This seems to jolt Haymitch out of his stupor, and he paws through the box in disbelief.
You what?
I tossed the lot, says Peeta.
He'll just buy more, I say.
No, he won't, says Peeta. I tracked down Ripper this morning and told her I'd turn her in the second she sold to either of you. I paid her off, too, just for good measure, but I don't think she's eager to be back in the peacekeeper's custody.
Haymitch takes a swipe with his knife, but Peeta deflects it so easily it's pathetic. Anger rises up in me. What business is it of yours what he does?
It's completely my business. However it falls out, two of us are going to be in the arena again, with the other as mentor. We can't afford any drunkards on this team, especially not you, Katniss, says Peeta to me.
What?
I sputter indignantly. It would be more convincing if I weren't still so hungover.
Last night's the only time I've ever even been drunk.
Yeah, and look at the shape you're in, says Peeta. I don't know what I expected from my first meeting with Peeta after the announcement. A few hugs and kisses. A little comfort, maybe. Not this. I turned to Haymitch. Don't worry, I'll get you more liquor.
Then I'll turn you both in, let you sober up in the stocks, says Peeta.
What's the point to this? Asks Haymitch.
The point is that two of us are coming home from the capital, one mentor and one victor, says Peeta. Effie's sending me recordings of all the living victors. We're going to watch their games and learn everything we can about how they fight. We're going to put on weight and get strong. We're going to start acting like careers, and one of us is going to be victor again, whether you two like it or not.
He sweeps out of the room, slamming the front door.
Haymitch and I wince at the bang.
I don't like self-righteous people, I say.
What's to like? Says Haymitch, who begins sucking the dregs out of the empty bottles.
You and me. That's who he plans on coming home, I say.
Well, then the joke's on him, says Haymitch.
But after a few days, we agree to act like careers, because this is the best way to get Peeta ready as well. Every night we watch the old recaps of the games that the remaining victors won. I realize we never met any of them on the victory tour, which seems odd in retrospect. When I bring it up, Haymitch says the last thing President Snow would have wanted was to show Peeta and me, especially me, bonding with other victors in potentially rebellious districts. Victors have a special status, and if they appeared to be supporting my defiance of the capital, it would have been dangerous politically. Adjusting for age, I realize some of our opponents may be elderly, which is both sad and reassuring. Peeta takes copious notes. Haymitch volunteers information about the victors' personalities, and slowly we begin to know our competition. Every morning we do exercises to strengthen our bodies. We run and lift things and stretch our muscles. Every afternoon we work on combat skills, throwing knives, fighting hand to hand. I even teach them to climb trees. Officially, tributes aren't supposed to train, but no one tries to stop us. Even in regular years, the tributes from District 1, 2, and 4 show up able to wield spears and swords. This is nothing by comparison. After all the years of abuse, Haymitch's body resists improvement. He's still remarkably strong, but the shortest run wins him. And you'd think a guy who sleeps every night with a knife might actually be able to hit the side of a house with one, but his hands shake so badly it takes weeks for him to achieve even that. Peeta and I excel under the new regimen, though. It gives me something to do.
It gives us all something to do besides accept defeat. My mother puts us on a special diet to gain weight. Prim treats our sore muscles. Madge sneaks us her father's capital newspapers. Predictions on who will be victor of the victors show us among the favorites. Even Gale steps into the picture on Sundays, although he's got no love for Peeta or Haymitch, and teaches us all he knows about snares. It's weird for me, being in conversations with both Peeta and Gale, but they seem to have set aside whatever issues they have about me. One night, as I'm walking Gale back into town, he even admits, "It'd be better if he were easier to hate." "Tell me about it," I say. "If I could have just hated him in the arena, we all wouldn't be in this mess now. He'd be dead, and I'd be a happy little victor all by myself."
"And where would we be, Katniss?" asks Gale.
I pause, not knowing what to say. Where would I be with my pretend cousin, who wouldn't be my cousin if it weren't for Peeta? Would he have still kissed me, and would I have kissed him back, had I been free to do so? Would I have let myself open up to him, lulled by the security of money and food, and the illusion of safety being a victor could bring under different circumstances? But there would still always be the reaping looming over us, over our children, no matter what I wanted. "Hunting, like every Sunday," I say. I know he didn't mean the question literally, but this is as much as I can honestly give. Gale knows I chose him over Peeta when I didn't make a run for it. To me, there's no point in talking about things that might have been. Even if I had killed Peeta in the arena, I still wouldn't have wanted to marry anyone. I only got engaged to save people's lives, and that completely backfired. I'm afraid, anyway, that any kind of emotional scene with Gale might cause him to do something drastic, like start that uprising in the mines. And as Haymitch says, District 12 isn't ready for that. If anything, they're less ready than before the Quarter Quell announcement, because the following morning, another 100 peacekeepers arrived on the train. Since I don't plan on making it back alive a second time, the sooner Gale lets me go, the better. I do plan on saying one or two things to him after the reaping, when we're allowed an hour for goodbyes. To let Gale know how essential he's been to me all these years. How much better my life has been for knowing him, for loving him, even if only in the limited way that I can manage. But I never get the chance. The day of the reaping's hot and sultry. The population of District 12 waits, sweating and silent, in the square with machine guns trained on them. I stand alone in a small roped-off area, with Peeta and Haymitch in a similar pen to the right of me. The reaping takes only a minute. Effie, shining in a wig of metallic gold, lacks her usual verve. She has to claw around the girl's reaping ball for quite a while to snag the one piece of paper that everyone already knows has my name on it. Then she catches Haymitch's name. He barely has time to shoot me an unhappy look before Peeta has volunteered to take his place. We are immediately marched into the justice building to find head peacekeeper Thread waiting for us. "New procedure," he says with a smile. We're ushered out the back door into a car and taken to the train station. There are no cameras on the platform, no crowd to send us on our way. Haymitch and Effie appear, escorted by guards. Peacekeepers hurry us all onto the train and slam the door. The wheels begin to turn, and I'm left staring out the window, watching District 12 disappear, with all my goodbyes still hanging on my lips.
Chapter 14. I remain at the window long after the woods have swallowed up the last glimpse of my home. This time I don't have even the slightest hope of return.
Before my first games, I promised Prim I would do everything I could to win. And now I've sworn to myself to do all I can to keep Peeta alive. I will never reverse this journey again. I'd actually figured out what I wanted my last words to my loved ones to be. How best to close and lock the doors and leave them sad but safely behind. And now the Capitol has stolen that as well.
"We'll write letters, Katniss," says Peeta from behind me. "It will be better anyway. Give them a piece of us to hold on to. Haymitch will deliver them for us, if they need to be delivered."
I nod and go straight to my room. I sit on the bed, knowing I will never write those letters. They will be like the speech I tried to write to honor Rue and Thresh in District 11. Things seemed clear in my head, and even when I talked before the crowd, but the words never came out of the pen right. Besides, they were meant to go with embraces and kisses and a stroke of Prim's hair, a caress of Gale's face, a squeeze of Madge's hand. They cannot be delivered with a wooden box containing my cold, stiff body. Too heartsick to cry, all I want is to curl up on the bed and sleep until we arrive in the Capitol tomorrow morning. But I have a mission. No, it's more than a mission. It's my dying wish. Keep Peeta alive. And as unlikely as it seems that I can achieve it in the face of the Capitol's anger, it's important that I be at the top of my game. This won't happen if I'm mourning for everyone I love back home. Let them go, I tell myself. Say goodbye and forget them. I do my best, thinking of them one by one, releasing them like birds from the protective cages inside me, locking the doors against their return. By the time Effie knocks on my door to call me to dinner, I'm empty, but the lightness isn't entirely unwelcome. The meal's subdued, so subdued, in fact, that there are long periods of silence, relieved only by the removal of old dishes and presentation of new ones. A cold soup of pureed vegetables, fish cakes with creamy lime paste, those little birds filled with orange sauce, with wild rice and watercress, chocolate custard dotted with cherries. Peeta and Effie make occasional attempts at conversation that quickly die out.
"I love your new hair, Effie," Peeta says.
"Thank you. I had it especially done to match Katniss's pin. I was thinking we might get you a golden ankle band and maybe find Haymitch a gold bracelet or something so we could all look like a team," says Effie.
Evidently, Effie doesn't know that my Mockingjay pin is now a symbol used by the rebels, at least in District 8. In the Capitol, the Mockingjay is still a fun reminder of an especially exciting Hunger Games. What else could it be? Real rebels don't put a secret symbol on something as durable as jewelry. They put it on a wafer of bread that can be eaten in a second if necessary.
"I think that's a great idea," says Peeta. "How about it, Haymitch?"
"Yeah, whatever," says Haymitch.
He's not drinking, but I can tell he'd like to be. Effie had them take her own wine away when she saw the effort he was making, but he's in a miserable state. If he were the tribute, he would have owed Peeta nothing and could be as drunk as he liked. Now it's going to take all he's got to keep Peeta alive in an arena full of his old friends, and he'll probably fail.
"Maybe we could get you a wig, too," I say in an attempt at lightness.
He just shoots me a look that says leave him alone, and we all eat our custard in silence.
"Shall we watch the recap of the reapings?" says Effie, dabbing at the corners of her mouth with a white linen napkin.
Peeta goes off to retrieve his notebook on the remaining living victors, and we gather in the compartment with the television to see who our competition will be in the arena. We are all in place as the anthem begins to play, and the annual recap of the reaping ceremonies in the 12 districts begins. In the history of the games,
there have been 75 victors. 59 are still alive. I recognize many of their faces, either from seeing them as tributes or mentors at previous games, or from our recent viewing of the victors' tapes. Some are so old or wasted by illness, drugs, or drink that I can't place them. As one would expect, the pools of career tributes from Districts 1, 2, and 4 are the largest, but every district has managed to scrape up at least one female and one male victor. The reapings go by quickly. Peter studiously puts stars by the names of the chosen tributes in his notebook. Haymitch watches, his face devoid of emotion, as friends of his step up to take the stage. Effie makes hushed, distressed comments like,
"Oh, not Cecilia,"
or,
"Well, Chaff never could stay out of a fight,"
and sighs frequently. For my part, I try to make some mental record of the other tributes, but like last year, only a few really stick in my head. There's the classically beautiful brother and sister from District 1 who were victors in consecutive years when I was little. Brutus, a volunteer from District 2, who must be at least 40 and apparently can't wait to get back in the arena. Finnick, the handsome bronze-haired guy from District 4, who was crowned 10 years ago at the age of 14. A hysterical young woman with flowing brown hair is also called from 4, but she's quickly replaced by a volunteer, an 80-year-old woman who needs a cane to walk to the stage. Then there's Joanna Mason, the only living female victor from 7, who won a few years back by pretending she was a weakling. The woman from 8, who Effie calls Cecilia, who looks about 30, has to detach herself from the 3 kids who run up to cling to her. Chaff, a man from 11, who I know to be one of Haymitch's particular friends, is also in. I'm called, then Haymitch, and Peter volunteers. One of the announcers actually gets teary because it seems the odds will never be in our favor. We star-crossed lovers of District 12. Then she pulls herself together to say she bets that these will be the best games ever. Haymitch leaves the compartment without a word, and Effie, after making a few unconnected comments about this tribute or that, bids us good night. I just sit there watching Peter rip out the pages of the victors who were not picked.
"Why don't you get some sleep?" he says.
"Because I can't handle the nightmares. Not without you, I think. They are sure to be dreadful tonight, but I can hardly ask Peter to come sleep with me. We've barely touched since that night Gale was whipped." "What are you going to do?" I ask.
"Just review my notes a while, get a clear picture of what we're up against. But I'll go over it with you in the morning. Go to bed, Katniss," he says.
So I go to bed, and sure enough, within a few hours, I awake from a nightmare where that old woman from District 4 transforms into a large rodent and gnaws on my face. I know I was screaming, but no one comes. Not Peter, not even one of the Capitol attendants. I pull on a robe to try to calm the goose flesh crawling over my body. Staying in my compartment is impossible, so I decide to go find someone to make me tea or hot chocolate or anything. Maybe Haymitch is still up. Surely he isn't asleep. I order warm milk, the most calming thing I can think of, from an attendant. Hearing voices from the television room, I go in and find Peter. Beside him on the couch is the box Effie sent of tapes of the old Hunger Games. I recognize the episode in which Brutus became victor. Peter rises and flips off the tape when he sees me.
"Couldn't sleep?"
"Not for long," I say. I pull the robe more securely around me as I remember the old woman transforming into the rodent.
"Want to talk about it?" he asks.
Sometimes that can help, but I just shake my head, feeling weak that people I haven't even fought yet already haunt me. When Peter holds out his arms, I walk straight into them. It's the first time since they announced the Quarter Quell that he's offered me any sort of affection. He's been more like a very demanding trainer, always pushing, always insisting Haymitch and I run faster, eat more, know our enemy better. Lover? Forget about that. He abandoned any pretense of even being my friend. I wrap my arms tightly around his neck before he can order me to do push-ups or something. Instead, he pulls me in close and buries his face in my hair. Warmth radiates from the spot where his lips just touch my neck, slowly spreading through the rest of me. It feels so good, so impossibly good, that I know I will not be the first to let go. And why should I? I have said goodbye to Gale. I'll never see him again, that's for certain. Nothing I do now can hurt him. He won't see it, or he'll think I'm acting for the cameras. That, at least, is one weight off my shoulders. The arrival of the capital attendant with the warm milk is what breaks us apart. He sets a tray with a steaming ceramic jug and two mugs on a table. "I brought an extra cup," he says. "Thanks," I say. "And I added a touch of honey to the milk, for sweetness, and just a pinch of spice," he adds. He looks at us like he wants to say more, then gives his head a slight shake and backs out of the room. "What's with him?" I say. "I think he feels bad for us," says Peter. "Right," I say, pouring the milk. "I mean it. I don't think the people in the capital are going to be all that happy about our going back in," says Peter. "Or the other victors. They get attached to their champions." "I'm guessing they'll get over it once the blood starts flowing," I say flatly. "Really, if there's one thing I don't have time for, it's worrying about how the Quarter Quell will affect the mood in the capital." "So you're watching all the tapes again?" "Not really. Just sort of skipping around to see people's different fighting techniques," says Peter. "Who's next?" I ask. "You pick," says Peter, holding out the box. The tapes are marked with the year of the games and the name of the victor. I dig around and suddenly find one in my hand that we have not watched. The year of the games is 50. That would make it the second Quarter Quell. And the name of the victor is Haymitch Abernathy. "We never watched this one," I say. Peter shakes his head. "No, I knew Haymitch didn't want to, the same way we didn't want to relive our own games. And since we're all on the same team, I didn't think it mattered much." "Is the person who won in 25 in here?" I ask. "I don't think so. Whoever it was must be dead by now. And Effie only sent me victors we might have to face." Peter weighs Haymitch's tape in his hand. "Why? You think we ought to watch it?" "It's the only quell we have. We might pick up something valuable about how they work," I say. "But I feel weird. It seems like some major invasion of Haymitch's privacy. I don't know why it should, since the whole thing was public, but it does. I have to admit, I'm also extremely curious. We don't have to tell Haymitch we saw it." "Okay," Peter agrees. He puts in the tape and I curl up next to him on the couch with my milk, which is really delicious with the honey and the spices, and lose myself in the 50th Hunger Games. After the anthem, they show President Snow drawing the envelope for the second Quarter Quell. He looks younger, but just as repellent. He reads from the square of paper in the same onerous voice he used for ours, informing Panem that in honor of the Quarter Quell, there will be twice the number of tributes. The editors smash cut right into the reapings, where name after name after name is called. By the time we get to District 12, I'm completely overwhelmed by the sheer number of kids going to certain death. There's a woman, not Effie, calling the names in 12, but she still begins with, "Ladies first." She calls out the name of a girl who's from the seam. You can tell by the look of her. And then I hear the name. Maisalie Donner. "Oh," I say. "She was my mother's friend." The cameras find her in the crowd, clinging to two other girls, all blonde, all definitely merchants' kids.
I think that's your mother hugging her, says Peter quietly.
And he's right. As Maisalie Donner bravely disengages herself and heads for the stage, I catch a glimpse of my mother at my age, and no one has exaggerated her beauty. Holding her hand and weeping is another girl who looks just like Maisalie, but a lot like someone else I know, too.
Madge, I say. That's her mother. She and Maisalie were twins or something, Peter says. My dad mentioned it once.
I think of Madge's mother, Mayor Undersea's wife, who spends half her life in bed, immobilized with terrible pain, shutting out the world. I think of how I never realized that she and my mother shared this connection, of Madge showing up in that snowstorm to bring the painkiller for Gale, of my Mockingjay pin, and how it means something completely different now that I know that its former owner was Madge's aunt, Maisalie Donner, a tribute who was murdered in the arena.
Haymitch's name is called last of all. It's more of a shock to see him than my mother. Young, strong, hard to admit, but he was something of a looker. His hair dark and curly, those gray seam eyes, bright and, even then, dangerous.
Oh, Peter, you don't think he killed Maisalie, do you? I burst out. I don't know why, but I can't stand the thought.
With 48 players, I'd say the odds are against it, says Peter. The chariot rides, in which the District 12 kids are dressed in awful coal miners' outfits, and the interviews flash by. There's little time to focus on anyone, but since Haymitch is going to be the victor, we get to see one full exchange between him and Caesar Flickerman, who looks exactly as he always does, in his twinkling midnight blue suit. Only his dark green hair, eyelids, and lips are different.
So, Haymitch, what do you think of the games having 100% more competitors than usual?
Asks Caesar. Haymitch shrugs. I don't see that it makes much difference. They'll still be 100% as stupid as usual, so I figure my odds will be roughly the same.
The audience bursts out laughing, and Haymitch gives them a half smile. Snarky, arrogant, indifferent. He didn't have to reach far for that, did he? I say. Now it's the morning the games begin. We watch from the point of view of one of the tributes as she rises up through the tube from the launch room and into the arena. I can't help but give a slight gasp. Disbelief is reflected on the faces of the players. Even Haymitch's eyebrows lift in pleasure, although they almost immediately knit themselves back into a scowl. It's the most breathtaking place imaginable. The golden cornucopia sits in the middle of a green meadow with patches of gorgeous flowers. The sky is azure blue with puffy white clouds. Bright songbirds flutter overhead. By the way, some of the tributes are sniffing. It must smell fantastic. An aerial shot shows that the meadow stretches for miles. Far in the distance, in one direction, there seems to be a woods, in the other, a snow-capped mountain. The beauty disorients many of the players, because when the gong sounds, most of them seem like they're trying to wake from a dream. Not Haymitch, though. He's at the cornucopia, armed with weapons and a backpack of choice supplies. He heads for the woods before most of the others have stepped off their plates. 18 tributes are killed in the bloodbath that first day. Others begin to die off, and it becomes clear that almost everything in this pretty place, the luscious fruit dangling from the bushes, the water in the crystalline streams, even the scent of the flowers when inhaled too directly, is deadly poisonous. Only the rainwater and the food provided at the cornucopia are safe to consume. There's also a large, well-stocked career pack of 10 tributes scouring the mountain area for victims. Haymitch has his own troubles over in the woods,
where the fluffy golden squirrels turn out to be carnivorous and attack in packs, and the butterfly stings bring agony, if not death. But he persists in moving forward, always keeping the distant mountain at his back. Maisalie Donner turns out to be pretty resourceful herself, for a girl who leaves the cornucopia with only a small backpack. Inside she finds a bowl, some dried beef, and a blowgun with 24 darts. Making use of the readily available poisons, she soon turns the blowgun into a deadly weapon by dipping the darts in lethal substances and directing them into her opponent's flesh. 4 days in, the picturesque mountain erupts in a volcano that wipes out another 12 players, including all but 5 of the career pack. With the mountain spewing liquid fire and the meadow offering no means of concealment, the remaining 13 tributes, including Haymitch and Maisalie, have no choice but to confine themselves to the woods. Haymitch seems bent on continuing in the same direction, away from the now volcanic mountain, but a maze of tightly woven hedges forces him to circle back into the center of the woods, where he encounters 3 of the careers and pulls his knife. They may be much bigger and stronger, but Haymitch has remarkable speed and has killed 2 when the 3rd disarms him. That career is about to slit his throat when a dart drops him to the ground. Maisalie Donner steps out of the woods.
"We'd live longer with 2 of us."
"Guess you just proved that," says Haymitch, rubbing his neck. "Allies?"
Maisalie nods, and there they are, instantly drawn into one of those pacts you'd be hard-pressed to break if you ever expect to go home and face your district. Just like Peeta and me, they do better together. Get more rest, work out a system to salvage more rainwater, fight as a team, and share the food from the dead tribute's packs. But Haymitch is still determined to keep moving on.
"Why?"
Maisalie keeps asking, and he ignores her until she refuses to move any further without an answer.
"Because it has to end somewhere, right?" says Haymitch. "The arena can't go on forever."
"What do you expect to find?" Maisalie asks.
"I don't know, but maybe there's something we can use," he says.
When they finally do make it through that impossible hedge, using a blowtorch from one of the dead career's packs, they find themselves on flat, dry earth that leads to a cliff. Far below, you can see jagged rocks.
"That's all there is, Haymitch. Let's go back," says Maisalie. "No, I'm staying here," he says.
"All right. There's only 5 of us left. May as well say goodbye now anyway," she says. "I don't want it to come down to you and me."
"Okay," he agrees. "That's all." He doesn't offer to shake her hand or even look at her, and she walks away.
Haymitch skirts along the edge of the cliff as if trying to figure something out. His foot dislodges a pebble and it falls into the abyss, apparently gone forever. But a minute later, as he sits to rest, the pebble shoots back up beside him. Haymitch stares at it, puzzled, and then his face takes on a strange intensity. He lobs a rock the size of his fist over the cliff and waits. When it flies back out and right into his hand, he starts laughing. That's when we hear Maisalie begin to scream. The alliance is over, and she broke it off, so no one could blame him for ignoring her. But Haymitch runs for her anyway. He arrives only in time to watch the last of a flock of candy pink birds equipped with long, thin beaks skewer her through the neck. He holds her hand while she dies, and all I can think of is Rue, and how I was too late to save her, too. Later that day, another tribute is killed in combat, and a 3rd gets eaten by a pack of those fluffy squirrels, leaving Haymitch and a girl from District 1 to vie for the crown. She's bigger than he is and just as fast, and when the inevitable fight comes, it's bloody and awful, and both have received what could well be fatal wounds. When Haymitch is finally disarmed, He staggers through the beautiful woods, holding his intestines in, while she stumbles after him, carrying the axe that should deliver his death blow. Haymitch makes a beeline for his cliff and has just reached the edge when she throws the axe. He collapses on the ground and it flies into the abyss. Now weaponless as well, the girl just stands there, trying to staunch the flow of blood pouring from her empty eye socket. She's thinking perhaps that she can outlast Haymitch, who's starting to convulse on the ground. But what she doesn't know, and what he does, is that the axe will return. And when it flies back over the ledge, it buries itself in her head. The cannon sounds, her body is removed, and the trumpets blow to announce Haymitch's victory. Peeta clicks off the tape and we sit there in silence for a while. Finally, Peeta says, "That force field at the bottom of the cliff, it was like the one on the top of the training center. The one that throws you back if you try to jump off and commit suicide. Haymitch found a way to turn it into a weapon. Not just against the other tributes, but the capital too," I say. "You know they didn't expect that to happen. It wasn't meant to be part of the arena. They never planned on anyone using it as a weapon. It made them look stupid that he figured it out. I bet they had a good time trying to spin that one. But that's why I don't remember seeing it on television. It's almost as bad as us and the berries." I can't help laughing, really laughing, for the first time in months. Peeta just shakes his head like I've lost my mind. And maybe I have, a little.
"Almost, but not quite," says Haymitch from behind us.
I whip around, afraid he's going to be angry over us watching his tape, but he just smirks and takes a swig from a bottle of wine. So much for sobriety. I guess I should be upset he's drinking again, but I'm preoccupied with another feeling. I've spent all these weeks getting to know who my competitors are, without even thinking about who my teammates are. Now a new kind of confidence is lighting up inside of me, because I think I finally know who Haymitch is, and I'm beginning to know who I am. And surely, two people who have caused the capital so much trouble can think of a way to get Peeta home alive.
Chapter 15. Having been through prep with Flavius, Venia, and Octavia numerous times, it should just be an old routine to survive. But I haven't anticipated the emotional ordeal that awaits me. At some point during the prep, each of them bursts into tears at least twice, and Octavia pretty much keeps up a running whimper throughout the morning. It turns out they really have become attached to me, and the idea of my returning to the arena has undone them. Combine that with the fact that by losing me, they'll be losing their ticket to all kinds of big social events, particularly my wedding, and the whole thing becomes unbearable. The idea of being strong for someone else having never entered their heads, I find myself in the position of having to console them. Since I'm the person going in to be slaughtered, this is somewhat annoying. It's interesting, though, when I think of what Peeta said about the attendant on the train being unhappy about the victors having to fight again, about people in the capital not liking it. I still think all of that will be forgotten once the gong sounds, but it's something of a revelation that those in the capital feel anything at all about us. They certainly don't have a problem watching children murdered every year. But maybe they know too much about the victors, especially the ones who've been celebrities for ages, to forget we're human beings. It's more like watching your own friends die. More like the games are for those of us in the districts. By the time Cinna shows up, I am irritable and exhausted from comforting the prep team, especially because their constant tears are reminding me of the ones undoubtedly being shed at home. Standing there in my thin robe, with my stinging skin and heart, I know I can't bear even one more look of regret.
So the moment he walks in the door, I snap. I swear, if you cry, I'll kill you here and now. Cinna just smiles.
Had a damp morning?
You could ring me out, I reply.
Cinna puts his arm around my shoulder and leads me into lunch. Don't worry.